So last week in my annual question box, I got to answer a bunch of questions. And just to reassure you, for those whose questions were not answered, our newsletter editor, Carolyn White, has agreed to put the rest of the answers in the September and October issues of the newsletter. So I've already sent them out, and they're ready to go. So I'm going to ask you two questions today. Who believes the quality of life has gotten better over the course of human history? And if you're brave, raise your hand. Who believes the quality of life has gotten better over the course of human history? Okay. Who thinks that this life that will continue to get better? Lot less, and some of you, you're still thinking about it. Yeah. Does that surprise you? No. So here's the trick. Humanity, we are hardwired for optimism. We are hardwired for optimism. That's the belief that the future will be much better than the past and the present. This is known as the optimism bias. Optimism bias. It abides in every race, in every religion, in every socioeconomic bracket. And we are up against that bias. We're addicted to happy endings. Pretty Woman, I've said this story before, but I want to bring it back. That wonderful movie, Richard Gere, Julia Roberts, want to make sure you're on the same page with me. And Julia Roberts, the wonderful, wonderful ending. The prince comes to rescue the bride, the princess in the apartment complex, and they save each other. That's the incredible line. They save each other, and she saved him in return. That was not the original script. The original script was very dark and had a very sad ending. And of course, this was a Disney movie. But they wanted more than just a Disney ending. They wanted something that was a little deeper, but they certainly weren't going to go that far and have a dark ending. So, and the audiences were very clear, we won't go to your movie unless it has a happy ending. There is a folk wisdom amongst storytellers that says, in the end, it's all good. And if it's not good, then it's not the end. So I have another question for you. What stories, scriptures, myths, science inspires you to get out of bed and commit to another day of love, connection, and existence? Perhaps you've been relying, as I have, on progressive 20th century optimistic theology. Optimistic. That is expectant, cheerful, preordained, predestined even. We know it's going to get better because, and I'll give you some choices that you may have made over your lives, the Enlightenment brought us that God is all good. Universe is good. Humanity is good. And therefore, all will be well. This theology is embedded throughout 20th century mainline Christianity, that we're on an upward trajectory of improvement. There are going to be some bumps and some bruises, but ultimately God is too good to let us fail. Unitarian minister Theodore Parker said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." We love that quote. President Obama loved that quote. Martin Luther King loved that quote. President Obama loved that quote so much he put it on the rug of the Oval Office when he moved in. Everybody forgot it was a Unitarian minister, but that's another issue. On the day after that Trump was elected, President Obama gathered his near-suicidal staff in the White House. And he said, "This is not the apocalypse." He said that history progresses. Sometimes it moves sideways. But I don't believe in the apocalypse. I don't believe in the apocalypse. This is not it. And I won't believe in the apocalypse until it happens. This is seductive. It's addictive. And that's why we elected him to 2 terms. Because we wanted to hear that again and again. Obama was just as much a part of the mainline optimistic theology as any of us. Much of the mainline theology was influenced by universalist beliefs. God is a loving God. God loves all, and universal salvation. All will be saved. By the mid-20th century, it had expanded into the mainline churches and included humanity, that we are all good as well. The original universalist theology, though, going back to the 18th and 19th century, it included the sins of humanity. We kind of forgot about that part. Unitarian theology, the inherent worth and dignity, really came from, and we all know it really means, that we're actually inherently good and divine. Through most of the 20th century, we have been ignoring our capacity for evil, despite overwhelming evidence. But hey, most of that horrific, horrific stuff that happened in the 20th century, that was somebody else. Read Americans, it wasn't us. We would never have let that happen in our country. We're too good. And then there's humanism. Been with us in its secular form since the 1920s. By our virtues we shall be saved. Creativity, fortitude, brilliance, and with the power of science, we will find solutions to the world's most vexing problems. Onward and upward from the age of reason, the scientific revolution has been fueling our progress, maintaining the steady beat of optimism. This is the one I was raised on, the one that has been supporting me and getting me out of bed. Authors such as Steven Pinker, author of The Better Angels of Our Nature and Enlightenment Now, provide ample secular evidence of how much better things have gotten. We can't deny that there's been a decrease in violence, reduction in illness and poverty. The statistics don't lie. But the headlines are also hard to deny. Climate crisis. There's a tyrannical manipulator in the White House. I'm just saying it. Vote. There's systemic racism entrenched in our white defensiveness. There are poverty-stricken, terrified migrants and refugees. They are desperate at our borders, and they are our neighbors as well. There's Iran. There's that nutcase in North Korea. And yesterday, one of the headlines I couldn't avoid, there was a Florida man who used a front loader to dump a pile of dirt on his girlfriend's car. We can't make this stuff up. I know some of the headlines, if you need to laugh, do so. I know you come to church in part because you need your optimism reinforced. You are coming in here with broken hearts. Your souls are bereft and your minds are confused about what to do. You come for comfort, for encouragement, and to have your faith affirmed. I'm not sure I can do any of that. My colleague, Reverend Nancy McDonald Ladd, who serves the River Road Unitarian Universalist Church in Bethesda, wrote in a wonderful book, came out last spring, After the Good News, Progressive Faith Beyond Optimism. There's a few copies available in the book nook. And I'm going to add my voice to hers and challenge the 20th century optimistic theology and humanist reliance on progress and toss it out the door. I think you may be feeling as tortured as I am around optimism. I've realized that my faith as a mystical humanist has been misleading me with a false and ultimately unreliable myth. My optimism bias has been my guidance system for most of my life, yet I've realized it's broken. I've come to accept human progress is not actually guaranteed. And there is no mystical presence bringing salvation via universal love. There may be a mystical presence, but it's not guaranteeing salvation. So there I've said it. And for those of you who are here for the first time in your church shopping, just wait a little bit. I invite you to resist crossing this church off your list. And for those of you who may be feeling triggered and defensive of your hard-earned and deeply entrenched optimistic theology, hear me out. With story after story of what appears to be the demise of humanity and the destruction of our planet, it's understandable that we may want to retreat. That's our flight response to terror. Others are, we're simply frozen with indecision, disempowerment. And some of us are fighting. We're fighting hard, but too often without a strategy or long-term plans or without allies. I've done all of the above. Wanted to retreat, frozen, fighting, often at the same time. Here's one very long perspective I've recently been playing with. 66 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Yucatan Peninsula, wiping out most of life in the northern hemisphere and doing considerable damage to the rest of the planet. Sorry for the dinosaurs. Any passing, intelligent life worth its weightlessness out there in space would have said, well, that planet is done. Where's the next bathroom break? Had they checked in, say, within the last 10,000 years, I think they would have been pleasantly surprised and quite shocked at the teeming life that was popping up and plodding around the planet. What a recovery, they would have said. Remarkable, they would have said. Extraordinary, they would have said. Life is resilient, they would have said. Wow, they would have said. Now, if they had checked in within the last year or so, they might be saying, let's take some bets on how they get out of this one, that little planet. Maybe we're seeing the end of another era, the human era of expansion. And if they're really, really smart, they'll stop and they'll offer us another planet because there are too many, many folks who are still ready to expand and take over yet another teeming with life planet. In this long view, the planet will recover from whatever ills and horrors we humans may inflict upon it. Humanity may not survive, but the planet will eventually. Not sure that this is the stuff that will keep me employed, though, or emotionally engaged. It's an intellectual construct. It's a defensive posture that relieves me of my lament, of my sorrow. What I have done recently is grieve. What I have done is cry and mourn. What I have done is let myself feel the pain. It is a transformative experience. Little by little, in fits and starts, I find my hope is being renewed. I realized when I really dug in, I was confusing optimism with hope. I understood the difference intellectually, but not in my heart, not in my body and soul. Hope is harder than optimism, and it requires daily maintenance, care, and staying attuned. Hope is not assumed. It's earned. It's developed. It's built out of hard work and a willingness to take risks, to be vulnerable, and to change. Hope requires us to be uncomfortable, profoundly uncomfortable. That's what Nancy's reading was about. Calling us to our call each Sunday, please, Pastor, make me feel comfortable again. I can't do that. We're not going to change until we're uncomfortable. Basic therapy rule number one. Are we willing to do this, though, with some humility? Some humility? Okay, a lot of humility. Rabbi Stuart Kelman has a story about when God created man. Man took a look around and said, I don't know what I'm doing. This looks hard. Saw God and said, can you give me a hand? Can you help me out here, God? And God said, I've never been man. I don't know how to do this. Man said, hey, look, I've never been you either, but I'm guessing that you know more than you're letting on. Why don't we just switch places? Then you can see what I see as a man, and I'll see what you see as God. All you have to do is switch your fingers, and that's it. Snap, we'll switch places. I'll see how it is to be God. You can see how it is to be man. And then I'll snap my fingers, and we'll switch back. God thought, hey, that could be useful. See what it is to be man. Okay, let's give it a try. God snapped fingers, celestial fingers. The God-man took a look around, now all this power, all this vision, all this capacity, and said, whoa. And the little man-god said, wow, this is interesting. Not a whole lot I can do. There's a few things, but this is really interesting. Not say I entirely like it. Okay. Looked at the God-man and said, okay, switch us back. I'm done. God-man said, yeah, I don't think so. Nope. Nope. And it's been that way ever since. We've just been playing at God. Total lack of humility. Never willing to say we don't know what we're doing. Why do you think the story of Noah is so hopeful? It's all in the end, everything's fine. Except that every ecologist who's ever heard that story knows that it's no way it could be fine because Noah brought the animals, but not the trees and the plants. There's no way anybody survived. The basic fundamental stem of life. 25 years ago, I was trained as a hospital chaplain in the first lesson I learned was to never ever say to a family that's just come into the ER or the ICU, never say the words, everything's gonna be fine. My supervisor said, you don't know that. And you're representing God. My job as a chaplain was to walk with them, to bear witness, to help comfort in their discomfort. My job with you is to walk with you in our mutual discomfort. One of the things that Nancy wrote in her book that I think is so true is that in our effort to leave behind all that stuff about the evil capacities of humanity, is we also left behind our lamentation, our capacity to grieve with one another. There is nothing in our liturgies that we carried forward from our Christian history, nothing in our liturgy that is our worship service that offers us a moment to say, I screwed up. I'm in pain. To say, help me. There is nothing to atone for our failings. Remember, we come by this honestly. We're hardwired to our unrelenting overestimation of our abilities and outcomes. Yet mistakes happen on a daily basis, and we don't offer a weekly ritual of healing. Someplace to name our failures, someplace to feel awful and uncomfortable, because we don't like that, do we? No. To give you an alternative theology, Black liberation theology relies on the naming of pain and suffering in the margins, of people living under oppression, under centuries of being used as a tool of objective capitalism as the form of chattel slavery. What Black liberation theology knows, that there is a profound transformation and opening that happens when we offer our unimaginable pain for others to bear witness. When we realize that none of us are walking on this path alone, and it is in that space that we can truly form connection. It is in that space that opens up when we say, I am hurting, I have failed, that we can truly be with one another. This is where I get my hope. When that happens, in that moment, when we can cry together, that is the source of my hope. When we connect, this is a profound act of trust. It's a huge leap of faith to love one another in our most vulnerable moments and know that we will be loved anyway. No one need walk alone on this journey if we don't want to. My job may not be to tell you everything's going to be okay, but it is to walk with you, to bear witness and hold you. And I'm saying that your job is the same, to walk with one another, to bear witness. That's what a community calls us to be. Together we create hope. Together we build hope. Once again and again and again. Another teaching of process theology, another theology that I offer you is process theology. You've heard me talk about it again, but I keep coming back to it again and again. It's a teaching that reminds us that this universe is constantly unfolding in any given moment. There is awkwardness, there's mistakes, there's errors, there's failures, but there is always an unfolding into the next moment. And in that moment is you and I faced with a choice. We are faced with a choice in each moment. Will we engage in competition for survival, power over, or will we engage in cooperation, in mutuality, in love and compassion? It's a choice in each moment, power or mutuality. Life is unfolding right now in this room and in this time. It is made holy by your presence, by your decision for mutuality, to come here this morning, to come here each Sunday, to come here midweek, to come here whenever you need to walk the grounds. Your presence brings the holiness into this room. As life chooses life and death, we choose our mutuality. It's going to take some humility. We are not the saviors, but we are active participants. I can't guarantee the outcome, but I can tell you that if we pack up and leave, if we retreat, then we are the asteroid. One of my teachers, Joel Banizzi, tells the story of when he was torturing his kids. Every week, he lives out in California in Berkeley where they have mangoes all the time. And every week they would have some mangoes. They all loved the mangoes. And he would say as he chewed into each new mango, he would say, oh, this is the best mango ever. And his kids would just say, oh, Dad, you said that last week. They can't be each the best mango ever. And he said, I'm older now, I'm wiser, I can appreciate this mango more. This is the best mango ever. My call to action for you, find the sweetness in each moment and share it. Know what it is, savor it. There, that's the foundation for hope. May it be so.